This is Anya Leonard, the co-founder of Classical Wisdom, a website dedicated to bringing ancient wisdom to modern minds. And today we have with us Professor Mirko Cannavaro, Professor of Greek History, Department of Classics at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland. Thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
So you have been working on Athenian decision making, which you know has to do with Athenian government and how they come to conclusions. Maybe you can help us understand this process a bit better by just explaining how it worked.
Yes. So the Athenian polis, the Athenian city, was run at least technically by 6,000 full rider, free-born male citizens over 18. 30,000 citizens, and the main body to make decisions together was the Athenian Assembly, at which most Athenians, all Athenians, could theoretically take part. But in reality, we know that the number that took part on any given session, and there were some 40 sessions or more per year, was something over the number of 6,000. How much over it depended on the particular occasion and how important the debate was. So Athens as a particularly large Greek city-state is an interesting case study of how a relatively large number of people, a mass democracy in a sense, can govern itself in a roughly horizontal way. When I say this, I have to point out that what I'm talking about, it when I say horizontal, is not that there were no people excluded. Of course there were people excluded. The population of classical Athens, there have been many, many different estimates, but we may talk about something in the region of 250,000, even 300,000 people. These included women, which of course had no access to political decision-making, included foreign residents that also didn't have any access to political decision-making, and included, of course, slaves, and these also didn't have any access to political decision-making, to law courts, to anything. So we're still talking about a minority of the population. But at the same time, we're talking about a minority that is legally defined, but is not socially defined, strictly speaking. It's a minority that is composed of people that are rather poor, the people that are all right, but not very wealthy, or people that are middle class, all the way to a financial elite. It's an assembly and is kind of a democracy composed of 30,000 free male adult citizens that can do anything from being members of the leisure class to working in the marketplace or having a shop as cobblers or being farmers, or there are so all sorts of working class jobs you can imagine. Well, you had people with full political rights in Athens that did them, and they participated. And we have evidence that many of these people proposed measures in the assembly, spoke in the assembly, participated as magistrates. So it's always a bit tricky to kind of, when we describe Athens as a democracy, to strike the correct balance, I guess, between representing this as an idyllic world of an horizontal place in which everybody is equal, there were a lot of categories that are excluded, but also not going too far the other way around, that is describing the Athenian citizens as something along the line of elite white male citizens. They were not elite. The majority of them was not elite in any meaningful sense. They were elite in the sense that they had political and legal rights, but many of them socialized mostly with metics or even slaves doing the same jobs at the lower level of the social scale. So it is interesting because it's exclusive from one point of view, but it cuts entirely across the whole social scale from another point of view. So that's the kind of social background of Athenian decision making. And then the question is, how do you get these many people from these many different backgrounds, doing these many jobs and with these very different interests, making decisions together without a structured government in any meaningful sense, without a prime minister, without, strictly speaking, any representative. There was nobody that was, there were a few people that were elected for particular magistracies, but their job was quite simply to execute what had been decided by the demos. So what I'm interested in is how they manage this. Yeah. Through a system of direct democracy, And the way they managed this was through, people always concentrate on the assembly, mostly on the Athenian assembly, as the place where everybody participated. But the reality was that the way they managed to make decisions together was through a layering of different bodies. So, for instance, any decision that had to be made couldn't be just brought up in the assembly. It had to be discussed first in the Athenian Council. The Athenian Council was a body selected by lot. It was composed of 500 people, selected by lot in a geographically determined way. So there were a certain number of people from any area of Attica so that there would be wide representation. So this body was, strictly speaking, representative, but they were selected by lot. Nobody could serve 2 years in a row, and nobody could serve more than 2 years throughout his life, which meant that a very large proportion of Athenians at one point or another served as members of the council. And this body was the first body that had to discuss anything. Whatever kind of problem, whatever kind of issue, whatever kind of decisions that needed to be made was discussed first there. They met virtually every day, except on festival days, and they were the ones that handled the agenda of the assembly. They created an agenda and they passed preliminary decisions, some open, just like, assembly, please discuss this and make a decision. Some closed, we recommend that you make this decision. Everything that was discussed there, then it moved to the assembly, to the Athenian assembly. And the Athenian assembly met, well, four or more times every month, not calendar month, there were only kind of 10 council months, so over 40 times per year. And everything was decided, was finalized in the assembly, but a large number of measures, for instance, would be voted on at the beginning of each assembly, just as they had been proposed by the council, and if they were fine, they would be nodded through. And then things that were not nodded through, or things that were problems, or things on, about which they needed to make additions, they would go to the debate stage of the assembly. And there would be a debate, there would be a vote, and would be decided. But when I talk about layering, and that's something I find quite interesting about Athenian democracy, I mean that there was even further stages. This was not the end of it. So, for instance, they may decide to pass a decree about the particular handling of a sanctuary, which required then smaller decrees on particular matters on a daily basis, and they may decide to give the council the power directly to make those decisions on a later stage. Or even a final decision made by the assembly could still be indicted by a public charge against an illegal proposal. And in that case, the same this decree, whether he had already been approved or whether he was about to be approved, when he was stopped by anybody that could just raise his hand and say, I think this is illegal, would have to go to a law court. And in a law court would be decided by an Athenian panel of judges, something in the region of 500 or more, also selected by lot. They were still Athenians, they were still random people, but it was decided on a very different way. And I think we'll get a bit into what I mean with different ways in a second, I guess. But so what you have is the demos, this entity, the people of Athens, that is embodied in a number of different bodies with very different institutional rules and which make decisions in very different ways. And the layering of these different bodies makes sure that the demos can make decision, is sovereign, the Athenian people has the power to decide whatever they want, but also that, in a way, the people, in its different capacities, keeps an eye on itself. It's some form of checks and balances, like we have in modern constitutions, except that instead of having a group of experts or some kind of elite or a judicial aristocracy doing the checking, in this case, it's just the demos that structures itself and entrusts to itself a number of different ways of making decision to look at problems from different angles. And that's how they made decision, through this layering of different bodies and of different structures, all manned and governed and run by the demos.
So are there options for corruption with this system? I mean, maybe the people who draw the lots get to decide who gets to be in the agenda making or this or that? Like, were there ways that this could be abused?
Well, there are many ways. I mean, there are many ways in which the system can be abused. The council stage of the procedure, in a way, and the local stage at the very end, they're kind of foolproof because, the council, because they select people by lot, the kind of influence that a politician can have, that a career politician or somebody or a member of the elite that has acquired significant political power can have in the council is very limited because there's no way for them to guarantee to themselves selection in the council. And because they are a small minority, on many given years, there won't be even one of them. So most of the decrees that we have coming from the council, they were proposed by people that we never heard before and were probably completely random people that just found themselves being in the council. And we know that, I mean, mathematically, you can kind of calculate of every, in any given year in the council, something between one third and one fourth of the people in the council will be people that have been there before, once before, only once. So there will be some knowledge about how things are run, but not too much that there is a large group of people that makes all the decisions. And the local stage is also very difficult to abuse. I mean, you can try to give a persuasive speech that is actually tricky and cast the issue in the wrong way. But you still have to convince 500 people that are selected by lot on the day through a machine for the lottery that is basically unhackable. That's a technological element of Athenian decision-making. They had the technology to make sure that, well, they just could not hack this thing. So you cannot know before the very day, before the very moment when you get into law court, who the judges are going to be, which means that any attempt to corrupt them is just impossible. It will never work. That's at least in the 4th century BC. So those two sides, those two moments are decently foolproof. The assembly stage is a bit more complicated because there are 6,000 people or more. Anybody can speak. There's a lot of people, direct democracy, everybody has to speak. There's a lot of noise. People express their opinions about what the speaker is saying by making noise, which we look at it as a negative thing. In a way, it can also be a good thing because it's a way for the demos to participate, not just by speaking, because it's impossible that over a day, 6,000 people can all take their turn to speak. But the fact that you don't speak doesn't mean that you don't participate. You can boo, you can heckle, you can do all that, or you can cheer somebody up. And you do get a way to participate in the debate, even if you're not actually speaking or making a proposal. But we're talking about a messy context. We're talking sometimes about certain decisions. We're talking about emotions running high. Thucydides is very keen on always stressing how emotional and irrational the Athenian demos was. Thucydides was no friend of Athenian democracy in a way. So like Plato and like a lot of philosophers and historians of less than democratic leaning try to make a point of stressing all the bad decisions that the Athenian democracy made. They can't have been all bad because they managed to run their country quite successfully for a long time. But that was a problem. There was that kind of problem. And of course, a good orator could stir this big crowd of people in one direction. And if the people, this crowd of people got set in a particular direction, it was very difficult then to move them to the other side, to swing them back. So you have the problems of crowd politics. You have the problem of some politicians with particular influence which use it badly. You can have problems of particular politicians that are, well, have sold out to somebody, so they're making proposals and speeches paid by, I don't know, Macedonian money, as Demosthenes claims Ischinus was, whether he was or not. So there are a variety of problems. But even when everything runs well, even when everybody does their job, still, in the kind of decision-making climate that you have in an assembly of 6,000 people, in which, as I am trying to argue at least, the ultimate aim is to achieve a certain level of consensus, and therefore in which social pressure is enlisted at the service of reaching a shared solution to a problem, a shared decision, then you have a certain amount of social pressure, of pressure for conformity, if you are the only one out of 6,000 people or more that thinks that's a bad idea, you need to have some guts to get up and tell. At the same time, though, it can't have been that bad to do that kind of thing, because one of Demosthenes, for instance, favorite strategies to start a speech and get the attention of the demos is saying, I know you all think the opposite, and I know what I'm going to say is going to be unpopular, but I have to say it anyway. And he does that every time, which people say, oh, how brave he was. But it must have worked. Obviously, if the demos was so against the idea of somebody speaking against the grain, that would have been a losing strategy. Whereas, obviously, it wasn't. It was a good way to get them to change their mind or to listen, at least.
So, in your opinion, would you describe ancient Athens as a true democracy or a deliberative democracy? And maybe, before answering that, explain what a true democracy should look like.
All right. So, well, that is a difficult question. First of all, the one distinction we should make is that one thing is trying to decide whether Athenian democracy was, in a way, resembling or fulfilling the condition that we would ascribe to what we call a democracy, which is also in the modern world, particularly in the modern world, a rather ill-defined category anyway. Just keep in mind that what we call a democracy, I guess, most Athenians and certainly most Greek political thinkers and most Greeks would have considered to be an oligarchy and not a democracy. And then there is a difference between that and a demokratia, what they call a demokratia. And certainly, in many ways, Athens was most certainly a demokratia. And the Greeks defined this in a very simple way. A demokratia was the kind of regime in which the power was held by the people. And with the people, they meant two things almost at the same time. They meant everybody, that is, everybody that was born free and was a member of the particular community. So all male citizens, that was their everybody. And therefore, with no exclusions based on census, on socioeconomic ground and all that. Or they meant the poor. And the two things were often conflated because they claimed, at least Aristotle claimed, in a regime in which the demos, as everybody, is in charge, then because the poor are a majority, then the poor are in charge. So, quite clearly, from the ancient point of view, Athens, there was no doubt that Athens was a demokratia. It was quintessentially what the Greeks defined as demokratia. And although in the Hellenistic period and by the late 4th century, most cities in the Greek world were governed by various forms of demokratia, Athens had some kind of paradigmatic position in that respect. Nobody ever doubted that classical Athens was atypical, actually for many, a radical, an extreme demokratia, in which the power of the demos was so strong that it was almost uncontrolled. From the point of view of modern democracy, it's difficult to say whether we can consider Athens a true democracy. They didn't have elections. They didn't have representatives as we do. They were, of course, a direct democracy. The number of people they excluded was, in significant ways, much higher than the number of people that are excluded in modern democracy. People that had full rights were a minority of the population of the country. They had slaves, they had women with no rights. So in those respects, if we consider a democracy from the point of view of its inclusiveness and from the point of view of how much stake and how much power in determining their own destiny as a community, the Athenians had, or the people that lived in Athens more widely had, then Athens would result heavily deficient because of all the categories that they excluded. At the same time, though, for those that it didn't exclude, which to them, from their point of view, was as large as you could go, at least. There are some signs, for example, in Aristophanes' utopian or dystopian fantasies about women taking power and the like. They could envisage a world in which women were, women had political rights, and at the same time, We do know, for instance, that Hyperides, when there was a threat of invasion from Philip II of Macedon to Athens, did propose that all slaves should be freed and made citizens so that they could fight against Philip. So they could envisage a world in which everybody would be enfranchised, but it was in the realm of utopian, or rather dystopian, fantasies. So from that point of view, Athens was less democratic, if we want to define democracy from the point of view of inclusiveness. How many people among those that live in a particular land, in a particular place, have access. From another point of view, though, we could consider it more democratic, because those that did have a stake, those that did make it to political rights, had much more control on their destiny than any inhabitant of our modern democracies will have a dream of, apart from the very elite and the people that run the state or whatever. So Athens was this weird place in which a cobbler or a sausage seller, to Socrates and Plato's disgust, could make decisions, war and peace and policy and the like, but at the same time where there were slaves, a lot of them, and women were excluded. It was this strange place where how wide participation was, not so wide by modern standard, but very wide by Greek standards, was offset by how deep, pervasive, and empowered participation was. Those that did make in had access. So I don't know how useful it is to talk about true democracy or not. I think perhaps one way to look at this, if we consider very simplistically democracy as a regime in which the demos has constitutionally control on how their collective destiny is decided, you should look at it as kind of a sliding ground of different levels of democraticness, and also with different access. In some respect, you can have wider participation, you can have deeper participation, you can have more popular control, you can have more or less exclusion of disadvantaged classes among those that are part of the community, but you can have more exclusion of particular categories altogether. And Athens perhaps fares better than modern democracy in terms of depth of participation. Athens doesn't look much like an oligarchy in any meaningful sense. He has an elite, but he's not defined on socioeconomic grounds, but also it's a very exclusive kind of community in which a lot of people don't have any access. So that's perhaps the kind of calculation we need to think about when we talk about Athens. And we can perhaps use it not much as a model, but more like a case study, Athens is something good to think with about all of this thing. And there are some access and some dynamics about which Athens will be a negative example. It's an example of extreme exclusion. It's an example, not an extreme example, but an example of a certain level of xenophobia sometimes. Not an extreme example, I want to repeat, because foreign residents had access to more or less full legal rights. Male foreign residents had access to full legal rights. It's an example of institutionalized misogyny. So in that respect, it's a negative example. But it's also an example of truly empowering the lower classes, at least part of them. It's an example of a regime that manages somehow to keep pervicaciously horizontal its distribution of power. Doesn't mean that it's fully horizontal, it's still hierarchical in a way, but it's much less hierarchical than in the modern world. And it manages to keep the elite at bay. It manages to keep them paying for public services. In Athens, only the top 4% in the wealth ladder pay any taxes at all. Wow. And nobody else does. And they pay a lot of taxes. And they pay for all the public services there are in the city. So there are all these different elements to keep to talk about. And in some respect, Athens is definitely a negative model. In others, it's an interesting model about self-government, about how you make decisions together in a mass direct democracy. It's even a model, I would argue, on how you get very, very different people from very different socioeconomic background to agree about a wide variety of stuff without excluding them and without indoctrinating them, just by creating a setup that stimulates debate, discussion, with a commitment to agreeing, because we are a community and we have to get to a common decision that everybody can feel they can then participate and they can contribute to playing out. And that's something we don't do very well in the modern world.
Do you think
different elements, different sides of this, yeah.
So do you think studying exactly how this decision making was done has sort of meaningful impacts or impact on modern political theory?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think if we look at Athenian democracy and at its system of decision making, freeing ourselves from some prejudice that comes from our own experience about what democracy looks like, then we start seeing things that are quite interesting and can contribute to modern political theoretical discourse. Traditionally, the way we look at Athenian democratic decision-making, political decision-making, is informed by our modern habits. So, for instance, we look at it, we consider it heavily agonistic. Democracy is the kind in which you have two parties, three parties, different groups, different interests, and they fight it out. And there's going to be a winner and there's going to be a loser. It's an agonistic system, and it's an aggregative system in which the point is not that you try to get everybody on the same page. The point is that you try to convince a certain number of people. There are a lot of people that will never be convinced. And the important thing is to aggregate preferences towards a majority of 50% plus one through sheer majority rule, which means that whatever decision you make, because you're only ever aiming for 50% plus one, there's always going to be a 50% minus one that loses. They won't be part of the decision. They are part of the decision in the sense that they have participated in making it, they have voted, they have lost, and they are committed to abiding by the decision of the majority, even if they never agreed with it. Mm-hmm. And this commitment may be ideologically represented as due to simple good citizenship, but often is also underpinned by the threat of force, police apparatuses and the like. That's our model, agonistic, aggregative, majority rule, and the threat of force behind it is not as rough and as hard in some places. Some European democracies have more consensual or consociational bodies that mitigate a bit. But that's basically the model. And we've seen it very well, for example, in recent years with the many, many referendums that are happening around Europe and around the world, in which you have very, very small majority making enormous decisions on behalf of everybody, and the people that lose out either being called traitors or suckers or whiners or whatever they call them, because they still don't really agree with the decision that has been made. It's been made through the proper channel, it's been made correctly, but they are left out. Those decisions in that kind of regime break the community at every time they have to decide on something important. There is somebody that loses out, and the only way for which that break in the community, in opinion, doesn't turn into civil war or an unhealable break in the fabric of a country or a community is because there's the police and there's the military, and there is an apparatus of force that makes sure that whatever is decided by the majority is going to be law, is going to be the rule, and everybody has to follow it. Athenian democracy worked in a rather different way. They made decisions in the assembly and in the council in a rather different way. They made decisions aiming for consensus. That doesn't mean that they always achieved consensus, but that means that the whole setup, the whole institutional setup, was organized in such a way that you had very, very slim chances to ever get a proposal through, not just to get it voted and approved, but even to get it put to the vote by the people in charge of deciding what would be put to the vote. And these people, by the way, were selected by lot for one day. So they changed every day. But you had very slim chances to get whatever proposal put to the vote unless you aimed to convince everybody. not just 50% plus one, not just particular pressure groups. In the speeches of the Attic orators, you never find anybody saying, oh, and this particular group of the population, the old, the poor, the rich, or whatever, well, they vote against, but will win, will prevail, because we have a majority. The target of decision-making and of persuasion is always the demos in its entirety, which is meant to be united behind the decision, and then when the decision is inscribed, features and the demos approve this and that. So the whole system was designed in such a way that people had to try very hard to get everybody to agree on something, which meant that they had to come to some sort of compromise often, but also which meant that they talk it through, talk it to death. They had to come to the assembly willing to be persuaded. They had to be willing to change their preferences because there was a commitment to agree to what was called homonoia, being of the same mind. And they were very much aware that if that didn't happen, and if the assembly and therefore the community kept splitting repeatedly across the middle, over and over again, and the 50% plus one kept losing, chances were that this would result in division and civil war, in stasis. The result of split votes, of repeated split votes, could be civil war and stasis, which was why they were so committed to homonoia. Now, all this is quite interesting, because if you look at Athenian democracy, then you start looking institutionally and ideologically and at the way they carried out their day-to-day business, and how you can have a commitment to consensus and to debate to get to a joint position, while at the same time preserving a decent amount of diversity, keeping the system open enough that people could express disagreement, while at the same time there was a certain amount of social pressure inbuilt in the system, so that if people really disagreed, they should bring it up during the debate rather than just vote against later on. This was a system in which people, to get something approved, really had to get everybody behind the proposal. But at the same time, if even just one person disagreed with it and felt very strongly that what was being proposed was illegal, all he had to do was to raise his hand, and everything would be blocked, and it would go to a law court to be decided whether it was legal or not. So, social pressure towards consensus on the one hand, at the same time, a certain level of safeguard of different opinions, and a certain almost power of temporary veto given to one of 6,000 or 7,000 Athenians on any given occasion. In political theory, we've had in recent years quite a drive, well, in the last 30 or 35 years, quite the drive to find alternatives to what are perceived as the failings of the liberal democratic system we are used to, and of majoritarianism, and so on. And this drive has brought to the birth of first a heavily normative, a heavily direct, as deliberative democracy, kind of democracy arranged around debate, around a belief, a normative belief that sustained debate in ideal or semi-ideal condition would lead to the triumph of the better argument and to consensus behind the better argument. This stuff, for a while, stayed only in the realm of theorization, and then they started trying to work it out in practice. And they started organizing citizen assemblies, organizing consultative bodies like deliberative polls with micro-publics that were briefed, random people selected to be vaguely by lot to be vaguely representative, and then briefed about all the options and made them to decide until they could come to an agreement. And this kind of stuff has been used, for example, to put together, for instance, the proposal of constitutional reform, of a new constitution for Iceland, for instance. It was used to work out the independence of Quebec, or the autonomy of Quebec, although the decision then was rejected by a referendum. So there's been a lot of experiments. Now, one problem about all this body of literature is, first of all, on the one side, it's too theoretical, too normative, and almost too idealistic. The idea is that the best argument would always win. What we're looking for are ideal conditions of debate, everybody will have to be perfectly rational, and then we'll come to consensus.
Yeah.
On the other side, it's sometimes a bit too dismissive of the possibility of actual implementation of anything resembling this model. So, for instance, the idea is that what you need is mini publics, micro publics, small groups of people, because mass publics, mass democracies are, to many deliberative theorists, suspect, because they are difficult to handle, they can get emotional and the like. Likewise, there is a certain suspicion for non-rational argument, for anything from noise to heckling to emotional appeals to even storytelling and different kind of things that can be used to persuade somebody, which are part of the normal life of anybody who's actually trying to make decisions. So in this sense, it's quite exclusive. This ideal democratic system is open only to people that are educated enough to sustain a fully rational argument. And by excluding emotional arguments, storytelling, and that kind of thing, it excludes full categories of people that are not suitable for this kind of democratic system. So it's a democratic system that turns very quickly towards people have been very suspicious about the notion of consensus, because many are, as liberals, very committed to diversity, and therefore there is a problem about a system that drives toward consensus that may silence particular voices and create conformity. Now, we can try as many experiments as we want, but in this respect, Athenian democracy, and in general, the world of the Greek city-states, have a big advantage. We may not go there and observe them in practice, but we do have a heavily documented case study of mass democracies, not as big as modern democracies, but still much bigger than any experiment we have done or we never dreamed of doing, working for hundreds of years, by the Hellenistic period, working with very similar procedures in over 1,000 city-states, making decisions about life and death virtually in this way. And we can kind of have a look about what works and what doesn't, what they actually could do and what they couldn't do. Something we figure out is that, for example, achieving consensus is not that impossible. People may start from very far away places and may achieve dirty, imperfect consensus. Some people will actually agree, some others will compromise, some others will think will pick their battle, some others may just decide that I'll agree, but for a very different reason from the reason you agree. But still, eventually, often they get to consensus. I mean, I always use the example, I have collected a lot of evidence about decision-making in the Greek city-states, and the consensual decision from the record we have appear to be the vast majority. And among the consensual decision, there's things like the Sicilian expedition vote after the famous debate between Nicias and Alcibiades. That's a very contentious debate. They argue heavily, they insult each other, there are many people talking, they seem to be irreconcilable. Very few people have paid attention to the fact that after all this irreconcilable stuff, at the end of the day, they decide unanimously to go to Sicily. And Nicias, that was the main opposer of the expedition, becomes the one that advises about the right provisioning of the expedition and becomes one of the generals.
Okay, so just to finalize up today, what are you working on right now?
Right now I'm working on a piece on a paper about another one of my projects, which is connected but not the same. It's a project that I'm running here in Edinburgh on a European grant. It's run by myself and my colleague, Professor Douglas Cairns, and it's called Honoring Classical Greece. We have a big team of people that we've managed to employ thanks to a European grant, which Brexit and no deal is putting into danger, but we'll not talk about that. and what we're looking at is the concept of honor in the Greek world, widely. What the Greeks call time and all the galaxy of concept around it. Eidos, hubris, this kind of concept. And what we are trying to argue is that time is a term used to identify a basic motivational mechanism that the Greeks believe correctly to be behind all sorts of social interaction. So Time is an interesting term. We normally translate it as honor, but in fact, it covers the full semantic range that we tackle with words such as honor, of course, but also dignity, respect, recognition, worth, value, even rights and prerogatives. What we call rights and human rights, they would have talked about this stuff in terms of timen, in terms of particular prerogative connected to your own worth. And this worth can be acquired in a variety of ways, either just by birth, because you're born an Athenian or you're born free, or because of exceptional performance at the service of the polis, or whatever. And this concept also underpins all social and political interaction at the private and at the political level. So there's a big project, there's a lot of stuff in it, we have a lot of people that work on different aspects of it. What I'm working on right now is the intersection between, in Athens and in the Greek polis more widely, the intersection between time as the public honors that the cities granted to public benefactors, and time as the prerogatives, the honor, the basic rights of the Athenian citizen or of the citizen of Priene or of Iasos or whatever other place. These were all called time, and it wasn't just vague homonymy. It wasn't just that they used the same word. It's because they considered quite close together. They considered them honor, worth, dignity, respect, and prerogatives attached to them, which come from the fact that you have a particular worth, a particular kind of value that may come to you from having done something great for the city or just from being born an Athenian. And what I'm interested in is how, right now, is how often the exceptional honors that the Athenians and other cities grant to benefactors, to public benefactor, often very much look like the very standard honor that most Athenians or most citizens of a Greek city may get just by doing their job as magistrate, being selected by lot. So on the one hand, they are supernumerary, they are exceptional honors, and on the other hand, is the kind of thing that in an ideal world in which everybody does their job properly, everybody would get. So there is a tension between egalitarianism and an attempt to verticalize the system that is in tension. And I kind of suspect that you can read a lot of developments in the Greek city as the fighting it off between these two ends of a polarity between vertical honor, the kind of honor that distinguishes, that is differential, that makes some people of higher rank than other, and horizontal honor, the kind of basic dignity that makes everybody equal and worthy of certain kind of respect. And I'm tackling this both from a philosophical point of view, both in terms of modern philosophy, a lot of work on recognition, on respect by scholars like by philosophers like Axel Honneth and Stephen Dowell, and ancient philosophers. Aristotle is my favorite to talk about this kind of thing, but also from the point of view of actual institutional and political and historical experience. I'm working a lot on the inscriptions, with the vast majority of inscriptions that come from the Greek world and from Athens too, are honorary decrees that are honoring somebody for some reason.
Oh, it must be really interesting looking at this from Aristotle, since, you know, he sort of believed that people who were slaves had a slave-like quality in them, and that's why I justified them being slaves.
Yeah, exactly. We actually one of the last events that we had within this project was a conference within Edinburgh in June on slavery and honor, and we were trying to tackle exactly these issues: can slave have honor, both in the conceptualization of the Greeks, but more generally, can you? Famously, Orlando Patterson, the great sociologist, has argued that the virtual universal characteristic of slavery is not the fact that some people are owned by some other people, so slavery is property, but the fact that, slaves are generally dishonored people that don't have access to any kind of honor or dignity or the like. And we're trying to explore this issue in the Greek world and in the sources. And something we found is that on the one hand, at the public level, at the level of the city, they seem to be very keen in making sure that no honor can be recognized publicly to a slave. And the reason for which they do that is that if you recognize honor to a slave, then you recognize that the slave has rights that can be enforced by law. And a slave cannot have rights, because otherwise that clashes with the absolute rights of property, of ownership by the master. On the other hand, though, and this is a point that is important for our project, despite having this particular notion and being so firm about it in the public level, because to talk about reciprocal relationship between two subjects, then that they always fall into that. So at the private level, in a variety of sources, they do talk about slaves in terms of honor. Even in slave management advice, for example, in Xenophon, in the Poroi, or in Plato, in the Republic and in the Laws, for instance, they do talk about the need to honor slaves. And they do talk about the fact that the best way to make slaves compliant is to foster their philotimia, their love of honor, by honoring them and praising them for good performance. The question is, of course, is this just ideological honor, ideological recognition, the kind of recognition that tricks slaves into subjecting themselves to the will of their master even more? And even if it is so, can slaves still build a sense of themselves out of this kind of praise, and can they use it against their master? We are arguing that they can. They do that. They can use it against their master because as soon as the master starts punishing for bad behavior and praising and honoring for good behavior, then he's binding himself to some kind of standard. So if he starts punishing somebody that has behaved well, then the slave doesn't just feel, oh, it's the master. He feels, I've been wrong. And in the Greek sources, most rebellion, most revolts are described in these terms. Masters didn't stick to this reciprocal bound that they had created, this reciprocal bond that they had created themselves, and therefore the slaves revolted or all that. We also look in how slaves can build a sense of themselves and of their own worth through the language of honor and associated elements among themselves, or in spaces in which they interact across social statuses, like what Vassopoulos calls free spaces. Shops, economic activity in which they work elbow to elbow with free individuals. So it's nothing like, we're not trying to argue that slaves had it good. In fact, we're arguing that they had it very badly. But we are trying to argue that human interactions, even in that particular context, are always based on dynamics of recognition, of mutual recognition. And as soon as you have a dynamic of recognition going, however asymmetrical it may be, however much the power imbalance, then in that dynamic of recognition, you can find the seeds for rebellion and for a new sense of themselves. And Greek slaves regularly did. That's what we're trying to argue. Not with their master, but against their masters, in a way.
Well, it's very fascinating. Well, I think we've covered quite an interesting spectrum from revolution and rebellion to the government of democracy versus oligarchy, and probably somewhere in between you can figure out how one leads to the other.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much again for talking with me today. It was very, very interesting, and I hope everybody enjoyed learning a bit more about Athenian decision-making and ancient government, really.
Thank you very much. That's been a pleasure. Thank you. Have we stopped the recording?
Yeah, I just clicked stop. I'm just waiting to make sure it pops up okay. Let me get this one.